This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Okay, so thanks very much for those kind words. So, was anyone here 3-4 years ago? Yeah, so a few of you. So I thought what I'd do tonight, we've got about half an hour or so and then some time for questions, is give you a bit of background to Beyond the Bike and then sort of try and draw out some of the economic lessons that we learnt on our voyage. Now, as Damon said, we've just come back from China. The route this time was, in theory, Canary Wharf to China, but we took a slightly circuitous route to get there. But just a bit of background to be on the bike. I was a city economist until 2009, so at the sort of the height of the financial crisis, I left City where I was working and fell into a teaching job. But it had always been an ambition of mine to take a bit of time out and do a trip. And the original cycle, as you heard, was from South Africa to London in time for the 2012 Olympics. Incidentally, inspired by my parents, their honeymoon was to drive a VW camper van the other way back in the 70s. But at that stage, not having a wife, I thought, well, the best way would be to do it on a tandem bike, and I can use the back seat to, not to pick up a wife, but actually to meet people like Mungwe. Mungwe was a Maasai. Oh, is a Maasai still? I hope he's still alive. And to use encounters with people that joined me on the back seat of the bicycle to tell the story of the economies that I was passing through. So Mungwe was on the Tanzanian-Kenyan border. He hadn't seen a tandem bike, and I don't think he cycled much. He certainly wasn't geared up for it. And we were sort of we're riding back to his village, and after a couple of kilometres, his tunic got cut in the or caught in the braking mechanism, and we came to a screeching halt. But he was an interesting guy. He had a sword, you can probably see on the side there, a staff, but he also had a mobile phone. And one of the sort of interesting sort of revelations for me on that trip was the fact that the mobile phone 4 or 5 years ago was so widespread in Africa. But not all encounters that I had were serendipitous. The first one in South Africa, a few days after we started, was with a minibus crashed into our support vehicle. We had a support vehicle for the first couple of weeks. A mate of mine, a colleague at the school I was teaching at the time, Cranley School, was driving it, and I dragged him out of the windscreen. Fortunately, it was the truck, not the minibus, that was that rolled, because I think there would have been some fatalities had it been a cheap minibus. But it got me thinking about various issues. That one in particular, the idea that life is cheap in Africa, and looking about how economists value life. The Department of Transport in the UK use a value of 1.2 million. The driver of the minibus certainly didn't reveal that he sort of put such a high value on life, much lower. And interestingly, another way of valuing life, that of slavery, widespread today. You can buy a child in West Africa for $10. When slavery was last legal in the 19th century, that price in today's money was sort of 50 times that. Other stories, Mohammed in the desert north of Khartoum, he joked, I think I used this slide last time, that when we got to his village that the mobile phone companies were competing with Allah for airtime, and sure enough, 3 mobile phone masts and 1 mosque. So that was the sort of the last trip. And it was about really about Africa. I think it's a fascinating continent. It's a huge place. This map, slightly controversial, but it does show the true size, as it says, of Africa, that you can fit the whole of the United States, Western and Eastern Europe, India and China, into the landmass that is Africa, and there's still a bit of space left over. But I got back to London. I'd been involved in a charity, Beyond Ourselves, that we're raising money for on the last trip. But I went back to teaching. I set up a economics department in a government school in Tower Hamlets, which was really interesting. And it felt like sort of London is the sort of the center of the world. The first GCSE class I had, there wasn't one white face. Most of the kids were Bengali, actually, from Asia, and it was really interesting talking to them about the trip and thinking about seeding the sort of the next trip. And these are the sort of students that I took to back to the office, the Tower Hamlets in the shadow of my old office. And I'd met Claire at the same time, or early on, and we were talking about doing another trip. And we're thinking, well, if we want to understand more about the sort of the world economy today, we need to get to Asia. And certainly these guys reinforce that. We had a couple of hiccups while we were planning. We went out for dinner on the tandem up in Islington, and came out afterwards and the bicycle was gone. There was a D-lock on the floor, and we took the D-lock to the Islington police station at about 11 o'clock. And the police officer, we had a bit of a laugh at the idea of trying to get it back. She said there had been 60,000 bikes nicked in London already, and it was only September. But we thought, well, surely it's a pretty unique bike. We must be able to find it somehow. So the next morning, after we'd sort of drowned our sorrows on that Saturday night, we sort of started writing a press release. We thought, no, let's just put it on Twitter. I put it on Twitter. I was fortunate to have met Freddie Flintoff and a couple of other well-known sports people on the previous trip. They retweeted in it very quickly. Within half an hour, it got out to about 1.5 million people. 40 minutes later, someone sent me a direct message on Twitter saying they'd just seen a couple of kids riding a tandem past the coffee shop they were in. And again, the sort of the power of social media and smartphones. A couple of hours later, we had the bike back. It was damaged, but we were ready for this new trip. And I think I mentioned it to Claire on our sort of second or third date, that whether she fancied cycling to China. And sort of why China? Well, Asia is the sort of the center of the world, certainly of population today. Half of the world's population live within that circle. Two-thirds of that circle is water. Obviously, the two most populous countries in the world are within that, India and China. A third of the world's children today are in India. And we're familiar with the economic statistics coming out of China. But certainly since 2010, the one that's blown me away, I think in the 4 years since then, China's put more concrete and cement down than the United States did in the whole of the 20th century. So we're thinking, fantastic, well, let's take a route to China. Why don't we follow one of the old traditional Silk Roads? And Claire, being a classicist, was really interested in this. Obviously, some of the ancient capitals of the world we'd be going through. When I mentioned this to her dad, that we might cycle through Baghdad and Iran and a few other countries, he wasn't very happy. So we sort of put our thinking hats on and researched a bit more about different Silk Roads. And the Silk Road is actually a relatively modern term. It describes ancient trade routes, but it was actually a term coined in the late 19th century to describe east-west trade routes. So with the 21st century interpretation of that, we thought, well, why don't we look at trade between Africa and Asia? After all, Africa, is it the sleeping giant? Is it the next Asia? There are going to be potentially 4 billion people in Africa by the end of this century. Surely the trade between Africa and Asia is going to be more significant over the next 100 years than Asia, Europe. So then we thought, well, that would be quite an interesting sort of economic journey following that route of natural resources from African mine to Asian factory. But the route of copper, does it really inspire or interest the sort of the classic student in today's classroom? Maybe not. So we thought, well, what products or good can we follow the route of as part of a journey? And the obvious one is the smartphone. It was I talked about mobile phones on the last trip. Smartphones weren't quite so sort of ubiquitous across Africa then, but now pretty much anyone, certainly in the Western world, but increasingly in the developing world, has got access to a smartphone. It's the fastest selling gadget in world history. As The Economist says there, 80% of adults in the world will have one by 2020. And it talks about the supercomputer in our pocket. The processing power of a smartphone today is faster than the computer that NASA used to put a man on the moon. So I think it's really having profound impact on the world economy. And we thought it would be interesting to follow the route of the supply chain, effectively, of that smartphone. I didn't know a couple of years ago that there are sort of 42 or so minerals used in the production of a smartphone, some of which are only found in pockets of Africa. So tantalum, for example, quite an important mineral in smartphones, can only 80% of it is found in the DRC. The DRC, we're familiar with the issues there. The civil war in the DRC has been responsible for more lives than any conflict since the Second World War. So as the Guardian journalist George Monbiot said, you know, he was looking for a smartphone that is not soaked in blood in reference to conflict minerals. So some real issues around the supply chain of electronics. And we partnered with a company, a social enterprise called Fairphone, and we'll tell you a little bit about them in a moment. So the idea was to do a journey from African mine, and we visited various mines, copper and nickel mines in Zambia, a rare earths potential mine in the same country. And this is Claire in early December with a bit of a hangover, taking a slide down into an artisanal gold mine just south of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. The gentleman in front of her was running the mine. He was, as you might expect, an evicted white farmer, and was trying to sort of eke out a living in a sort of an old mine. At the time, the gold price was quite depressed, and he wasn't really making any money. Incidentally, I think there are about sort of 35, 40 of us here this evening. If we took all of our smartphones together and took all the gold out of it, there would be more gold in our smartphones than there would have been from a ton of ore coming out of this mine. And that was it's a sort of typical gold mine in terms of productivity. Conditions down there, we were down in the mine for about half an hour, weren't particularly pleasant. And it was primitive mining sort of to dynamite shovels to get the ore to the surface. And again, mining is a dangerous workplace, and lots of issues around the supply chain of mining, not just conflict minerals, but about general working conditions. And to do that journey from African mine to Asian factory, lots of issues around around sort of worker conditions in factories that have been well documented. So Fairphone, pretty interesting company. They're tiny relative to the giants Apple and Samsung, but they're quite interesting. So the three things that they're looking to do is, one, to try and ensure that their minerals are ethically sourced. Secondly, to ensure that people working on the phone in their factories are fairly paid. And I think the third, which is most interesting, is trying to encourage consumers in the West to repair and recycle their phones. So I don't know if anyone here has actually taken their phone apart and tried to repair it. Interesting. So when we ask this question to kids, a few of the sort of more entrepreneurial ones do that. But actually, you'd be breaking into you don't have the intellectual property from Apple and Samsung to do that. But Fairphone are really trying to encourage that, and that's me trying to have a sort of take my phone, or the phone that we were given apart in Amsterdam. So our route was a slightly circuitous one, as I said, to get to China. We did a small warm-up ride in Europe to Amsterdam, where Fairphone are based. We then flew to Uganda, partly to pick up the other bicycle, which was a bamboo bike, which I'll talk about in a minute. We cycled down via sort of the mining areas of Zambia and Zimbabwe, popped into the DRC, spent some time with Beyond Ourselves, the charity that we were supporting in Africa, and then got down to Durban for Christmas. We flew across to Asia and then followed one of the, what actually is one of the new Silk Roads up from Singapore to China, and stopped in at United World Schools, the other charity that we were supporting. And there were sort of three aims from the trip. The first was to do the cycle and have some fun. We wanted to cycle at least 10,000 kilometers. I think we managed just over 11,000 or 11 million meters, as someone said. I think that's the best way to make it sound impressive. The second was trying to raise money for two great charities, Beyond Ourselves, as I said, in Zambia. This was a picture I took, 5 years ago. One of the elders in the community that we were working in had, I think, a nice quote on the back of his T-shirt, which I think is very relevant today. And education actually is, in that part of the world, is quite cheap, less than £15 a month in Zambia to educate a child. And then we had in Cambodia, Tim is here actually, who runs UWS, so if you're interested, do speak to him at the end. But there were 16 of us or so cycling around, visiting some of the schools in northeast Cambodia. It was hot, it was tough, but it was great. It was great fun, and we raised a lot of money for the schools there. And it was great to actually visit some of the schools and see some of the excellent work that they're doing there. And then the final objective, which sort of talking about tonight was the economic angle of the trip, as well as following the supply chain of the Fairphone, looking at the role of China in the world economy, and then just the general understanding of what's going on in the ground through conversations with people we met and people that were on the back of the bike. So we had a tandem and there were two of us, but we decided to take two bikes. I was on a tandem, and for most of the journey, this is right at the start in Uganda, Claire was on a bamboo bike, related to sort of fair trade and sort of ethical consumption. A bamboo bike's fantastic for a number of reasons. It looks great, but it only takes a couple of months, to grow your bike, so it's a properly renewable source. And the idea, as I said, through the conversations with people on the back of the bike, from the head of DFID in Rwanda, interestingly, Laure Beaufils is French, but she runs DFID. I don't think that would happen the other way. David was an American businessman traveler that we met on the Tanzania on the way to Zambia from Tanzania. We actually had to break him out of jail after, and we'll maybe come back to that later. Chief Dines in Kalenge in northeast Zambia. Interestingly, this was right in the northeast of Zambia, near the source of the Zambezi, miles away from anywhere. She had been to China. The Chinese authorities had flown her and all the other chiefs in Zambia out to China to improve relationships. Met quite a few Chinese people in Zambia as well, having a beer with a couple of guys in northern Zambia that drunk me under the table that they were paying, so I wasn't complaining. From anti-poaching rangers in Zimbabwe, this man actually had been on Radio 4 a couple of months before this, talking about Cecil the Lion, the most famous death in Africa since Nelson Mandela. He was an expert on conservation. A pastor that we gave a lift to a church, and he gave us a sermon under a tree in 40 degrees just down the road from the South African border. And then in Asia, a former government economist in Singapore, who now works for Citi, and a Buddhist monk in Thailand. All these people had interesting perspectives on the countries that they worked and lived in, and it was fascinating discussing them, whether it was on the bike or not. And we tried to turn those conversations through blogs into sort of teaching ideas. We visited a lot of schools in the countries. This was giving an economics lesson early on in the trip in Uganda. This was Claire talking at an international school, a prestigious international school in Singapore. Incidentally, the photo that she's talking about was a volcano that we climbed in the DRC, the sort of blowing it up there. Definitely recommend it if anyone's got a week's holiday. You camp on the top of the rim of the volcano and you can sort of watch into it at night. It's sort of, I imagine what Mordor would have been like in the Lord of the Rings. But as well as live visits to school, plenty of Skype lessons back to the UK and to schools around the world. This was a class in Koh Samui, learning about a business class, learning about the social enterprise of bamboo bikes. And actually just this morning, I was on the call to a school in India, talking about fair trade and conflict minerals. A really interesting lesson that I've been delivering through Microsoft Skype in the classroom. And then these lessons or resources were built by a teacher at Tutor2U, our educational partner. So what were the lessons that sort of we learnt from the trip? Well, one of the things that we were interested in doing, it wasn't so much a lesson we were given, but one of the things that we were looking to explore was the role of technology in education. This was a story I think I referred to at the last trip, at the last talk 4 years ago. And effectively, a non-profit technology educational company, One Laptop Per Child, they did a sort of experiment in Ethiopia. They dropped tablet computers into two remote villages in just near Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, where there were no schools, and so the kids were illiterate. They explained to the elders how to recharge the tablets using solar power, and then they just let the kids loose on the tablets. They were preloaded with educational apps, and they just wanted to see what would happen. Within, I think, 4 minutes, the kids had learned how to turn the phone on. Within a couple of days, they were using, on average, something like 20 apps per child. Within 2 weeks, singing ABC songs around the village. And within 5 months, one of the kids had hacked into Android. Now, there were various conclusions drawn from this. One of them was, they said, getting kids into or access to technology would be more important than giving them schools as a teacher. I'm not sure about that, but certainly in places in Africa, with the population growth as it is and the under-resourcement under-investment in education, using technology effectively is going to be really important. Half of the world's children, UNICEF reckoned, by almost the middle of this century, will be in Africa, and 40% of the world's population by the end of this century. So I don't think technology is going to replace teachers, but teachers that don't use technology will be replaced. And we try to sort of see, visit schools that were looking at using technology in sort of lower income countries and schools. And anecdotally, we're a little bit disappointed. Some sort of NGOs that were looking at, this is an NGO called Rumi, that were looking at using tablets in schools in Uganda. And the tablet was locked away in a classroom and wasn't really being used. That's just anecdotal. I think there are some examples of much better use of that in sort of bigger chains. So Bridge Academy, some of you may have heard of, who run hundreds of schools in Kenya and are expanding quite fast. They've got investors in Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and Pearson. Controversially, they use untrained teachers following scripted lessons that are downloaded from a tablet. But I think they are more successful than a number of state schools or government schools in those countries. Interestingly, a lot of, in the UK, there's a big debate about private versus state schools. In the UK, private schools are for the privileged few. In the developing world, in low-income countries, about 20-25% of kids go to private schools. Bridge Academies, Omega schools, there is actually for-profit companies trying to serve poor communities around the world, so sort of charging fees of 20p or so a day. And they are, although it's causing controversy, the Liberian government, for example, the Guardian article here, has turned to them to replace failing schools. So I think that's an ongoing discussion, but certainly we do need in the educational sector to embrace technology and use it more. One of the things we looked at early on in the trip was the role of aid. Certainly an age-old question in Africa is the role of foreign powers, from sort of European imperialism in the 18th, 19th century to aid in the sort of post-war period to sort of neo-colonialism from China in the 21st century. And we were lucky enough to discuss these sort of questions with the head of DFID in Rwanda. I'm not going to say too much about it. Should we be spending that much of our GDP on aid? Certainly, I think some of the criticisms are valid. When we were over in the DRC, for example, loads and loads of very expensive 50 grand Land Cruisers being driven around by expats, while the locals, although these were just a couple of kids playing, these sort of prehistoric bicycles were being used by sort of tradesmen to get stuff around. And that's one of the sort of classic criticisms, which I think is valid. I think aid does have a role to play, and we're talking about sort of government aid as opposed to sort of the small charities. But I think I have become a bit more sceptical over the last 5 years, but I'm pleased to see the sort of post-2015 agenda moving sort of away from sort of pure aid towards working with other multilateral institutions on sort of environmental issues and the like. Stepping back from aid to the sort of the colonial legacy from sort of the European powers, pleased to see not that many young Africans too sort of worried about that anymore. But I thought the trip we took down Lake Tanganyika is worth sharing with you, and it was quite fun. So the MV Liemba is a ship, the main ferry that goes down Lake Tanganyika. Lake Tanganyika is the longest lake in Africa. It's the second most voluminous lake in the world, and it goes all the way basically from southern Rwanda, Burundi, all the way down the coast. On one side is the Congo, on the other side is Tanzania. And in 1915, the Germans thought that the World War I was going to move to East Africa, so they took a warship out to the lake. The war didn't really go to East Africa, but when they realized they were going to lose to the Brits, they sunk the ship and the Brits resurfaced it in, I think, 1924. And since then, it's been a ferry running up and down the lake. And we were delighted to find it in Kigoma in the northern port when we arrived there. And we got some tickets and we clambered on, and it was chaos. You can imagine, those of you who've travelled in Africa, whether it's a bus or a ship, you think they just fill it up and they don't leave until it's full. So we've discussed this with the captain. We said, "Oh, you know, are you full?" And he laughed at us and said, "No, it's only half full. You can see mattresses, there's a palm oil, pineapples, all sorts of things on the ship, but it was only apparently half full." And the ship sails down for 48 hours down to the north of Zambia. It saved us a couple of weeks of cycling. And there's only two proper ports. So when it stops at the villages, and there are about 25 villages and towns it stops at en route, boats sort of swarm around the ship, and there's people jump down, babies are thrown, mattresses, all these sort of things during the night and during the day. And at the just before we arrived in Zambia, I sort of woke up and went out onto deck, and there was a BMW, I think, 3 Series parked on that had been sort of buried beneath all the pineapples and mattresses. I mean, why is that relevant to economics today? I think, you know, one of the positive legacies maybe of European sort of colonialism was an investment in infrastructure that has been lacking, or was lacking, through the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s. And what we have seen more recently, when we're sort of discussing whether Chinese investment has been beneficial, is that certainly there has been a decent amount of investment in transport. Not necessarily the trucks. This was a truck that we didn't like the look of in Zambia, but the roads were very good. Mark Beaumont, some of you might have heard of him. He's a sort of cyclist, adventurer, sort of explorer. He broke the world record cycling from Cairo to Cape Town last year in 43 days. And let me tell you, he would never have been able to do that 15 or 20 years ago, and it's sort of partly thanks to the better infrastructure that the Chinese have built on the continent. Plenty of valid criticisms of Chinese involvement in Africa, but I think there's more of a move towards trade rather than aid when it comes to the sort of the Chinese involvement compared to that sort of Western model, and I think that is certainly a positive. That's not to say there aren't criticisms. We spent a lot of time in the Copper Belt, and I've visited Ndola 6 or 7 times in the last 6 years, and have been interested to see the building of this football stadium by China Aid. And it is somewhat, I think, of a white elephant. Millions of pounds have been spent on it. It was meant to be built for the as a warm-up stadium for the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, but it was still being built when we were there in 2010. And a lot of the labour working on the stadium, you could see they were Chinese, and the local sort of rumour was that it was Chinese prisoners building it. And that's a sort of common criticism that you hear across Africa, and to be honest, across other countries where China have been investing, not employing enough local workers, and Chinese sort of state-owned companies winning the contracts to build these things. Talking about elephants, another sort of negative impact of not just of Chinese growth has been the effect on poaching in Africa. This was actually our most popular blog that we wrote, and looking at one of the sort of the external costs of the sort of trade with Asia, and at the current rate of poaching, there won't be an African elephant left in the wild in 12 years' time. We stayed with a couple of anti-poaching units. You saw the guy with the semi-automatic rifle resting on my shoulder earlier. We spent a bit of time with another unit in Zambia. And while these guys are doing great work, I don't think they're really going to win the battle. They're working at the point of supply. It needs to be the point of demand. I think there is some low-hanging fruit to be had in terms of trying to educate consumers in China. 2/3, for example, in a recent survey of respondents in China thought that elephant tusks grew back like fingernails. I don't think there's much danger of that happening with these elephants here. Anyway, so I think probably enough on Africa. From Zimbabwe, we went down to Durban, had Christmas there. That's where a lot of the minerals go onto ships and get out to Asia. And then we flew to Singapore via Dubai with Emirates. And one of the questions that, you know, a lot of development economists talking about is, why is Africa lagged behind Asia? And this chart sort of summarizes, I think, that quite neatly, looking at the growth of Singapore and Korea against Zambia and the DRC. 50 years ago, there were quite a lot of commonalities between Singapore and Zambia. Recently transitioned from British rule, peacefully in both cases, run by strong leaders, Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia, LKY in Singapore. But now, as you can see, Singapore, the third richest, I think, country in the world, 60 or 50 times wealthier than Zambia. And so why is that? Is that better leadership? LKY was a Cambridge-educated lawyer, and was really, you know, one of the key reasons why Singapore has been so successful. And one of the things we looked at talking in Singapore relating to LKY was whether benign dictatorships actually can be a good thing. You know, half of the world's population live under dictators. We were certainly educated in classrooms sort of 20 years ago that it's not good. But plenty of examples on our route. Paul Kagame in Rwanda, the late Sheikh Zayed from the UAE, LKY in Singapore, arguably some of the guys in China, have the sort of prosperity that they've created, I think, more than offset some of the criticisms in terms of how they get there. And I think, interestingly, the financial crisis has not spawned a crisis of capitalism, as we might have expected, but maybe a crisis of capitalist democracies. And it's interesting the last few years to see the growth of sort of strongman politicians around the world, from Putin in Russia coming back to the Kremlin, guys in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, potentially Trump in the White House, although I hope not. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Some dictators can be benign, some of them have not been. And from Singapore, we carried on north through Malaysia into Thailand and Cambodia, and Pol Pot there, one of the worst of the dictators, although nothing on the scale of Chairman Mao, if we think about the great leap forward or the great leap backwards. But as I say, we headed into Thailand. The first time we really started to notice more tourists. Interestingly, in Thailand, there are a million more male tourists than female tourists each year. And we sort of entered Thailand and Cambodia with a slightly sort of stereotypical view of sex tourism, certainly not condoning it. But I think we were left with realizing we had several misconceptions that, you know, we think about sex tourism as sort of European men going out and finding a sort of a Thai bride. Interestingly, the person that picked us up from the airport in Heathrow, a taxi driver, was the next day flying out to for a date that someone he'd met online in Thailand, and he was hoping to marry, he told us. But I think the misconception is actually that the local sex industry is bigger and shadier, and that certainly, whilst not condoning it in any sense, we felt that our anecdotal experience was that many of the sort of Western men in some ways were the ones being used. And the third point which we looked at in this blog was that actually the working conditions and wages can be better than the other main industry in Cambodia and Thailand, that of sort of garment manufacturing. So one day on the way into Phnom Penh, past lots of girls going to school and had some interesting chats, and then being passed by lots of lorries with women going to work, and then the lorries turned off and they were going to this footwear company that, when we looked them up later in the day, turned out as a Taiwanese manufacturer, one of the leading suppliers to Walmart, and there have been some quite violent demonstrations about working conditions in that. So certainly, whilst not condoning sex tourism, I think we've got to be careful about stereotyping things, and also thinking as much about some of the other products that we consume in terms of You know, where does the T-shirt, where do our trainers come from? And either way, I think education is certainly a solution, and giving kids and girls in particular an education gives them a different career path. And it's great to see the work that UWS were doing in that regard. From Cambodia, we headed north into Laos. We enjoyed our third New Year's celebration in Luang Prabang, which was a massive water fight, which was quite nice given it was about 45 degrees. And then we headed into our final country that is China. A lot of debate at the moment as to whether China is heading for a hard landing. There's no doubt that the growth is slowing, but is it going to be a significant recession that's going to affect the rest of the world? Anecdotally, we saw plenty of evidence of overinvestment in the cities that we cycled through. This is on the outskirts, I think, of Guilin, where loads and loads of new residential investment with the cranes either stopped or not working because the sort of property developers had gone out of business. And we met one English-speaking guide who had bought a flat. The developers had gone out of business, and I think she was on the 20th floor, and there was no power in her block. So I guess walking up 20 floors was keeping her fit, but she wasn't very happy. But the common narrative there is that the corporate sector has expanded too fast. It's been fueled by state-sponsored lending that is continuing despite evidence of non-performing loans. And I sort of discussed this anecdotally with people and had a couple of interesting meetings with economists in Hong Kong. And I think the conclusion I drew was that the key is whether there's the political will to reform and sort of semi-privatize the state-owned enterprises. And certainly whilst local government and corporate debt is very high, central government and consumer debt is still relatively low. So I don't think it's necessarily the disastrous situation that a lot of people are sort of forecasting over the next 2 years. Although, as I was saying to students when we were looking at GDP statistics, I'm not sure we can trust the Chinese ones anyway. I think they've been about 7% GDP growth to within 0.1% for the last few years. When we were sheltering from the rain just outside Hong Kong, went in to look at buying a new flat. Well, we were trying to be sold a new flat. £60,000 for 110 square metres seemed like better value than here in London. And then I guess the final thing that we looked at in China and sort of bringing the whole trip together was looking at the new Silk Roads. And I think whether China experiences a hard landing or not partly depends on the success of its signature foreign policy. The Chinese government do refer to it as the new Silk Road, or formerly One Belt, One Drive. It's a massive investment in... there's a new Silk Road fund worth $40 billion, as well as... which was launched at the same time as the new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank in 2014. Our interpretation of the Silk Road maybe is a little bit out of fashion in the short term. The focus of bank lending in China has moved away from Africa. 50% of it was in Africa 3 years ago. Now the majority of it is in Asia. So when the Chinese government talk about the sort of new Silk Roads, they're talking really about transport and sort of pipeline infrastructure being developed from China into Central Asia, down into Southeast Asia, and also talk about trying to get a railway all the way from Beijing ultimately to London, but that's quite a long way off. We ended up following the route of a proposed new railway to an extent for all the way from Singapore to Kunming, the capital of Yunnan province in southwest China. And talking to a lot of people on the way, economists and business people about the role of Chinese, it was a similar discussion to the one we had in Africa. In Thailand, for example, the negotiations over the railway had been going on for a number of years, and the standoffs over who builds it, where the raw materials and labour come from. But I think either way, what's interesting is that there's little coincidence that China's new foreign policy coincides with the aftermath of an investment boom and the associated overcapacity now in need of new markets abroad. And ironically, I think, you know, could we be seeing Lenin's theory that imperialism is driven by capitalist surpluses now hold true in the last ostensibly communist country? Either way, when we talk about Silk Roads, I hope that today's new Silk Roads will follow their predecessors and help spread the exchange of innovation and ideas that we need to sort of take the planet peacefully forward. Sort of Lenin, to an extent, was talking about the causes of the First World War when he was talking about sort of capitalist surpluses. And we certainly, I don't think, can afford a third today. So a lot of the issues are around the sort of South China Sea and other sort of geopolitical tensions, hopefully they can be resolved peacefully. So just to sort of conclude, you know, what were our sort of main lessons from the 10 months that we had getting to China? First one, I think, you know, we're both teachers, so we obviously value education, but I think it's we can't have too much investment in education. It does need to harness technology. More trade in the exchange of ideas, not less. Maybe some worrying signs in the world economy in terms of Brexit, the rise of Donald Trump and sort of populist isolationism is a worrying sign. As well, to an extent, the rise of social media, there's some fantastic power that can harness, getting our bike back when it gets stolen, for example, but there is a little bit of an echo chamber, and arguably it's promoting less debate and exchange of ideas, not more. And just finally, I think the trip reinforced our belief in humanity. Despite all the news flow, negative news flow around the world today, the world, I think, is still a safer place than you realize. And we were blown away by the kindness of strangers in, whether it was in the DRC on this trip or Sudan in the last trip, but across the world, the normal person is incredibly kind. And we'd certainly recommend anyone to get on their bike if they can have a bit of time and go and experience it for yourself. So thank you very much for listening. I'm going to take some questions.